Good morning and welcome to this February 8th, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access our podcast later in the show. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. So happy to be doing what we do always do, which is welcome authors onto the show. I'm excited this morning to chat with veteran writer Roxane Gay and debut novelist Kayla Ray Whitaker. Roxane and I spoke last Friday and a pre-recorded an interview then, which I will play now, and Kayla will join me for the second half of the show, so stay tuned for that. Right now, Roxane Gay. Roxane Gay's writing appears in Best American Mystery Stories 2014, Best American Short Stories 2012, Best Sex Writing 2012, A Public Space, McSweeney's, Tin House, on and on. She is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She is the author of the book Aidi, An Untamed State, the New York Times bestselling Bad Feminist and Difficult Women and Hunger is forthcoming in 2017. It is Difficult Women that we are talking about this morning. And she's also the author of The World of Wakanda for Marvel Comics. Roxane, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. It is a hell of a time for us difficult women these days. These poor difficult women are being born into quite a time. But before we get too far into that, and we will, I'll just let you talk about Difficult Women, talk about the collection as a whole, kind of what was on your mind at the time this was being written and kind of how the collection came together.
Difficult Women is some of my older fiction. And, you know, I think I have pretty much the same obsessions that I've always had, which are stories about women, the kinds of things that women have to deal with, and how women respond to trauma and betrayal. And also, I mean, there are some stories that I think are full of joy and full of hope. Even in my darker stories, there is hope, because there always has to be something that the characters are reaching toward that is hopeful. Otherwise, you know, why go on?
Right.
What's the point of it all?
Right. So tell me a little bit about how the collection came together. You wrote these stories over a period of how much time? And then did you always kind of have a collection in mind about difficult women? Or did you look at, you know, 30 stories and say, oh, I kind of see some themes here, and maybe these, you know, 15 go together?
Yeah, no, I wrote the stories mostly between 2009 and 2013, and it was the first book I ever tried to sell, in fact, and it's the first book I got my first agent with. And so as I was writing the stories, I was not thinking about a collection. I was just writing the stories because I wanted to write them, and I had something to say about, you know, each of the characters in those stories. But then as I started to accumulate a body of work, I realized I have a collection here. And so the collection was originally called Strange Gods, but last year a book came out called Strange Gods. And though it was an entirely different genre, I decided, let me think of something different for the title. And so I decided to call it Difficult Women, because in all of the stories, there are women who might be considered difficult or who deal with difficulties, and it just felt like the right container for the energy of all the stories.
And now it's coming out at a time when we all have nasty women on our brain and are wearing nasty women t-shirts. I was like, this would be a great nasty woman collection.
It would. You know, it's interesting. It is an interesting time for the book to come out, because women are dealing with an unprecedented level of misogyny. And I think a lot of us are still reeling from November 8th and the fact that Hillary Clinton was not elected president.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask, you know, I know these stories were written at a time, all of them probably before a time when we thought this, you know, amazingly awesome difficult woman would be our next president. And I, you know, I sort of feel like the collection probably has a newborn urgency even greater than it might have had she been our new president, that these issues, that we can't be complacent anymore, and that, you know, the struggles that women are facing, the violence against women, the misogyny, is even, I it's always relevant, but it's almost even, you know, more urgent, I think, now that the book is being born into even a more important time.
Yeah, there is an urgency, I think. And in some of the stories, dare I say, some prescience. In my story, Noble Things, I write about a country that experiences a second civil war. And I wrote that story after the 2012 election because I was looking at an electoral map. And I thought, that electoral map looks an awful lot like the Union versus the Confederacy. Uh-huh. And here we are again in 2016, or now 2017, with an electoral map that is very much the same as the one in 2012. And I think there's a lot to be thinking about in this time.
It's a, you know, it's an interesting question to me. I keep vacillating between feeling like art is now more important than ever and we really should be doubling down on the arts, and then, you know, what's the point? You know, artists should be spending every moment of their time resisting and every moment of their time protesting. And I think it's an interesting question, the place of the artist at a time like this, how power is best served. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about how you see your role as artist and writer in this particular time.
You know, I think a lot of people are making a lot of really ridiculous and grandiose statements about what people should be doing right now. I think people should be doing the best that they can. And we need to be protesting, and we need to be holding this administration accountable for so many of their egregious policies. But I think art is more important than ever. I think art has always responded to and held administrations accountable and will continue to do so. And so as a writer, I feel like the best thing I can do is use my voice and to comment on the world and the state of the world, and in particular the state of this country and how marginalized and vulnerable people are dealing with an administration that has no interest in their interests. So I very much believe in the power of art right now, now more than ever.
Yeah. And using your voice against Simon and Schuster, I think we were all applauding that decision. I mean, it's just a wonderful way to make, you know, a statement against people's choices. Congratulations. I thought that was wonderful.
Oh, thank you. You know, I did not think it was going to be a news story, that's for sure, because who cares? I mean, Simon Schuster could care less. You know, I just did what I thought was right, and I would do it again.
Yeah. I think a lot of people cared. I mean, it definitely got everybody, I think, you know, thinking about ways you can exercise your own power, ways you can show resistance in unconventional ways.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of times people worry about how they can make a difference, and sometimes it just takes one person to say, I resist. And, you know, you recognize that you're just one person, but it's still better than nobody.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Roxane Gay. The book is Difficult Women. It is out and available now. I would love for you to talk a little bit, you know, writing sex for writers is so fraught with peril. There are a ton of pitfalls. And when somebody does it well, I think it really gets our attention. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, kind of writing effective, not cliche, not squirmy sex scenes, I think is tough. And you're the master at that. So I was wondering if you could help us.
You know, well, I actually, when I was a much younger writer in my 20s, I was submitting writing to magazines and it was getting rejected. And so I started submitting that work to erotica anthologies. And so I had a whole career writing erotica before I was discovered by the literary establishment. And so I think a lot of it just comes from a lot of practice and just thinking about, you know, I think that sex is a really interesting narrative device. It's a location for desire and joy and anger and insecurity and confidence. It's just for everything. And so there's always an interesting way to engage in storytelling through sex. And I just try to avoid all the awkwardness that people tend to write into sex. It's just very strange the way many writers approach it. And so I just try to, like, do the opposite.
Well, that's good advice. It's working well.
Thank you.
It's interesting because I think one of the pieces of what makes these sex scenes work well is that in a lot of cases, the women aren't motivated by desire, or they're not motivated by the sex itself, and they're not motivated by, I don't know, you know, just like conventional, you know, I want you really bad. They're motivated by either a need for punishment, or there's some other motive that's driving them towards it, and which makes each scene very, very interesting and operating on several levels. I don't know how much that plays into your thinking that women are after something else in these scenes.
I mean, yes and no. And some of the, you know, I think they're after physical satisfaction, or they're after forgetting, or they're after absolution. I mean, they're definitely always in search of something. It just depends on the circumstance, really.
Yeah, yeah. I think the role of men in this is really interesting. That there are kind of a lot of bad men in here, I thought your use of them. So a lot of the men are kind of flatter and a little bit more one-dimensional, which here I think worked really well because it allowed the women to take a bigger part of the screen almost, and to, you know, kind of use the men as almost a foil to work off against. And do you see it? I don't know if you see it that way, or if you, the kind of how you thought about the men in a lot of these stories. I mean, there's so many stories, it's kind of hard to generalize across them, but I don't know. I thought that was a really interesting kind of device to use men in a particular way. Am I making any sense?
Well, I think it's always wonderful to use men. And you know, in a lot of these stories, you know, I've heard quite a lot from people about how all the men are bad, but not all the men in my stories are bad, just most of them.
Yeah, right.
I think I'm very interested in the ways in which people are terrible to one another, and the ways in which men oftentimes make women's lives unnecessarily difficult. And so absolutely you're going to see that come up in my stories over and over again, because it's just something that intrigues me, and it's an obsession, really. And I just look at the very different ways in which men can be destructive. And I'm interested in where that comes from. Where does that instinct come from? And I have yet to figure it out, but my stories are certainly in search of answers to that question.
Yeah. Let's take one of the stories that may have given you the most trouble, a story that I don't know if either you worked the longest on and kind of was a mystery to you, or a story that started in one place and ended up in a place that you absolutely didn't expect it to end up, and kind of walk us as writers through that process of a story revealing itself to you in really surprising ways.
Oh, you're asking me to pick a story?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know which one it would be that, you know, kind of was baffling to you, or that, you know, was kind of the most difficult for you to get your arms around, and kind of how you went about that process of doing it.
Sure. You know, my process is very strange in that I think a lot about my stories before I ever write them down. And so I'm not a writer who struggles a lot, which sounds weird, and I don't mean that in a weird way. It's just the truth of my process. I think the story that I found most challenging was the story How.
Uh-huh.
Because there was so much backstory that I wanted to communicate to the reader. It's a story about twin sisters and their missing mother who comes back, and they have a father who's relegated to the basement because he's not a great man, and they are one of the sisters who's really kind of the new matriarch of the family is in a marriage that she's not thrilled about, and she's actually in love with her best friend. And so there were a lot of moving parts, and I had to make very careful choices about negotiating all those moving parts and making sure I was telling enough of the backstory so that by the time we got to the end, the reader understood why these women made the choice that they did.
I love it. I love it. You know, the one of the lovely things about the short story form is it really allows you to play with structure. And, you know, I think How is a good example of that. I think Difficult Women, the title story, is a great example of that. And then there's a story, let me look at the title of it. Well, Difficult Women, as well as it's a story where you were kind of moving around a neighborhood and Florida.
Oh, yeah, Florida.
Yeah. But it's really fun, I think, for short story writers to be able to play with structure and to be able to kind of step out of the conventions of a novel or step out of, you know, kind of the conventions of normal arcish narratives. And, you know, I thought there were a number of stories in here that are really instructive, both to writers and fun for readers to kind of be able to say, you know, what a short story can do. And I don't know if that's something that you've played around a lot with in different, you know, kind of approaching narrative in different creative ways or anyway, if you can talk kind of about structure and...
Yeah, definitely. I play with structure a lot just to challenge myself because, you know, we have the traditional way of telling a story, that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that you start with a situation and there's rising action to a climax and then falling action to some sort of resolution. And that there's a reason why that story structure exists. It works. But to challenge myself as a writer, I'm always thinking of new ways of telling stories and ways of rearranging the traditional narrative structure. And so in a story like Difficult Women, I was really thinking about the tropes of womanhood, where women are crazy or frigid or slutty, and why are we given these labels? Why are we constructed in this way? And so it was really fun to challenge that and then think of it as lists and scenes. And so that was a really fun story to put together and to just rethink this idea of narrative entirely. And so in a lot of the stories that have non-traditional structures, I was just challenging myself and seeing what I could come up with.
Very fun, very fun. My guest this morning is Roxane Gay. The book is Difficult Women. Let's go back to something you said earlier about thinking about a story before you sit down to write it and how that makes it much easier. And I'm intrigued by that process because I hear so many writers say, I had no idea where this was going to go. And, you know, I just sat down and, you know, one thing led to another and there was the story. So I think approaching it with kind of this forethought is really wonderful and interesting. And if there's a way to make things easier on people, why don't we all do that? So to kind of tell me where some of these stories start. Does it start with an image? Does it start with a character? Does it start with a problem? And then you work through kind of all of that in your head before you sit down to the page?
It really just depends. I mean, every story is different, but oftentimes I start with a phrase, or I see someone walking down the street, like wearing a yellow top hat with a flower coming out of it. And I think, how did they get the confidence to leave their house like that? And what's their story? Or I think of a scenario and I decide that, okay, I'm going to write that story. And so there's always a moment of inspiration. And it's oftentimes just from like walking around or being out in the world. And then I build from there, and I just start to go to work in my head. There are, of course, times when I sit down and I just write, and I don't know where things are going, but I like to have a sense of where I'm going to take a story, and it might change. But I always start with something when I sit down to write. And oftentimes I sit down knowing exactly what's going to happen because I've done so much of the writing and drafting in my head. And that just helps me. I am not a formal outliner by any stretch of the imagination, but I do it in my head.
Yeah. Do you think the voice between, I know you work a lot in the nonfiction realm and do a lot of speaking engagements. Do you feel like your voice is really in place where that's not something you have to think about anymore, that the voice is always there? Or do you find that, okay, now I'm switching to nonfiction, I need to find my nonfiction voice, or I'm switching to short fiction, I need to find that voice? Do you feel like that's settled?
Yeah, my voice is there now. Certainly when I was younger, I was in search of my voice or in search of the most effective ways to use my voice, but I'm fairly confident in my voice these days. And whether I'm writing fiction or nonfiction or giving a lecture or doing an event, you're going to know it's me.
Right. I love that it's you across you and not, I do think that people slip into something different for, kind of academic articles or for essays or for speeches. And you knowing it's you is, it's a great place to be, right? You just kind of get to settle down and be.
It is. I think that's one of the most important things a writer can do for themselves. There are a lot of things I have yet to learn about writing, but I do know my voice and how I see the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about endings, because I feel like that is a trick for, particularly for short story writers. Endings are, in a short story, are often more unsettling, more ambiguous than they are in the novel. And knowing when you've arrived at the end, I think a lot of writers tend to overwrite the ends of short stories. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of knowing when the story has come to completion?
Yeah, when I am trying to figure out the story ending, I always think about giving the reader about 85% of the resolution and satisfaction that they're looking for, and just leaving about 15% of the story untold so that there's just a little bit of a ragged edge to the story. That's generally when I know a story ends. I always want there to just be a sense of, okay, I saw how the story ends, but, just still a little openness. And that's what I think makes the short story so beautiful, that you could have that sort of ending and openness at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And you also do comic books. Yeah?
I do.
You're working on a comic book. That's wonderful. Tell me a little bit about kind of switching to that part of your brain. Do you do the visuals as well, or are you just...
Oh, no. Oh, my God. I can't even draw a stick figure. I write the scripts. And so I'm writing World of Wakanda for Marvel, and it's a lot of fun. It's a very unexpected opportunity, but one that has really helped me expand my understanding of storytelling. And so I write a script, and basically it's a 20-page script, and I put a number of panels on each page, and I just write an explanation of what's happening in each panel and the dialogue, of course. And then the artist for World of Wakanda thus far has been Alisa Martinez, who's wonderful. And she takes the script and she draws it. And then someone else actually does the inking. And a third person, a third artist does the lettering.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I think it's, we're entering into such a kind of uncharted political territory here that it's hard not to look at the forces of good and evil in our society and sort of, imagine Obama's the superhero that's going to come in on his, Superman cape. And it's interesting to order the world, I think, in sort of almost like fairy tales and almost, comics are just somehow keep popping up in my head as I'm watching the world unfold here. And I think that could be kind of an interesting storytelling method as we go forward here, perhaps.
Absolutely. Comic books in particular have always been the purview of good versus evil. And right now we are in the middle of a battle between good and evil. And so I think that it's a very relevant form of storytelling right now.
Yeah, right.
The big bad wolf is definitely at our door here for.
Yeah, he is.
Talk a little bit about your role as teacher and how that, you know, the role is at university and serving your writing. If that, if you feel like you are still learning as much from your students as. You know, if they kind of feed back to you, if that helps your writing, or if it's just an exhausting way to
make money. Definitely. teaching is always exciting because you just never know what students are going to come up with. And I find that they challenge me to take more risks in my own work. And I love seeing the ways that they're willing to break the rules. Without necessarily knowing that they're breaking the so-called rules. And just, it's always inspirational, and I don't mean that in a cheesy way, but just to be around other writers who are trying to improve their craft. I think that's what we're all trying to do always. And so, yeah, it's very fun.
Yeah.
And it's not something I'm going to be able to keep up forever because I'm so busy, but... it's definitely a lot of fun.
It's good for now, yeah. Is there writing advice that, kind of favorite writing advice as we're drawing down on our time that you are fond of giving them that you can give our writing audience now?
No, the best writing advice I give my students is that all writing advice is terrible.
Right.
It's just so bad. It's so bad. And the reality is that everybody is different. And, you just have to look, you have to sift through the range of writing advice out there and just take what works for you and abandon what does not.
Yeah. Do you, I know you're an avid reader. Are there books on your bookshelf now that you're telling people to run out and buy beyond difficult ones?
Yeah, sure. Right now I'm reading, I just finished Eat Only When You're Hungry by Lindsay Hunter, which is awesome, and it comes out, I think, in late July, early August, and I also read, and it's out in June, it's called, oh, God, this is so bad, I can't remember the name of it, oh, it's by Camille Dungy, and I just blurbed it, which is horrible of me.
I can't remember the title.
I'm going to tell you the title of the book. It's called Guidebook to Relative Strangers by Camille Dungy.
Oh, there you go. Right.
And it's a really beautiful sort of love letter to the natural world and to motherhood and history. I really enjoyed that.
And your own memoir is coming. What month is your memoir coming out?
June 13th.
That's fantastic. Is your creative life extending to the novel, or are you going to stick in the short fiction form, or do you love, I mean, I know you've done so much across all of the genres. Are you contemplating?
I have written a novel.
Oh, you have written a novel. That's a long time ago.
It was out in 2014. It's called An Untamed State.
Right. I'm sorry.
And it's going to be a movie soon.
Oh, it is. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
There's nothing you have not done. That's fantastic.
The only thing I don't do is poetry.
Well, never say never.
No, I will say never about
say never.
That. I just don't have a talent for it. I read poetry and love poetry, but I cannot write it.
Yeah. It is a wonderful place to spend our time these days, though. I do find myself reading more and more poetry in these kind of dark times.
Absolutely. I try to read a book of poetry a week.
Yeah, it's a good solve.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Roxane Gay, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
That was Roxane Gay. We are going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Kayla Ray Whitaker will join me for the second half. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can visit Barbara's website. We're there too. It's penonfire.com for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. I want to bring your attention to several, actually, upcoming literary speaker series events going on in Orange County. and LA. If you have not heard, February 22nd, 7 o'clock p.m., novelist Dawn Tripp and Norman Olsted will be at the Scape Gallery in Corona Del Mar. Check that out. You can find information about that on our website. George Saunders is going to be on the show with me next week, and George is coming to town. He's coming to LA, so if you want to make the drive up there, George will be there on February 27th at 7:30. He will be in conversation with Anthony Mara. It is through the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. You can find information on that through the Aloud series, the Library Foundation of LA, and definitely tune in next week to hear my conversation with George. And finally, Literary Orange, if you don't know, is coming up April 1st. Tickets to that often sell out, so check out Literary Orange. And that is that. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Kyla Ray Whitaker was born and raised in Kentucky. She's a graduate of the University of Kentucky and of NYU's MFA program, which she attended as a Jack Kent Cook graduate scholar. Her debut novel is The Animators. It's out, only been out for 1 week. It's getting a lot of acclaim. It's published by Random House, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Kyla, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having us on, Marie. This is great.
You know what? It's so funny because we went on the air and I said, I want to make sure that I'm pronouncing your name right. And then I didn't. It's Kayla. It's Kayla.
That's okay. Yeah. No, it's one of those funny things. You don't realize that you have an accent until you have an accent. So the way I say Kayla is maybe kind of funny.
Nope. It was absolutely me. It was 100% me. That's so funny.
That's okay.
Okay. So, all
yeah,
right.
Happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you on. This spectacular debut novel. Congratulations.
Thank you.
This is great. So it's only been out a week, so I'm going to guess that not all of our listeners have had a chance to pick it up. So I'm going to let you talk about it and take us into the world of these two wonderful women and their animation life.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So the Animators is the story of two women, Sharon and Mel, who they're business partners and they're artistic partners. They make animated cartoons together, but they're also very, very good friends. They are best friends, I think. And the book follows their friendship from when they first meet in college, when they're 18 years old and young punks, into their 30s. At which point they have their first major success after more than a decade of struggle and eating ramen noodles and scrimping and saving and working out of this dank little studio in Brooklyn, making cartoons together. And the book basically documents what happens to their relationship and how the relationship is threatened after they've had this major milestone, this success in their lives. And of course, there are lots of other threads running through this story as well. There are romantic relationships, and there's family struggles, and there's secrets that they've kept from one another, and so there's a lot to the plot. But at the end of the day, the book is about their friendship, and it's about women making things, which I think is an endlessly fascinating subject.
I want to get into that for sure in just a second. Talk about the point of origin of the book, kind of where the seed of this came. Did it come with these characters? Did it come with animation? Tell me a little bit about, how you accessed the novel.
Sure. So it was character first. And I always feel best. I feel most secure about a project when the character is in the clearest relief. If the character comes first, then it's like the plot and the rest of the story, it will come as long as the character and the voice comes first. And the story really started with Mel. I heard Mel's voice first, and she wasn't talking about cartooning and she wasn't talking about craft, but she was actually talking about her childhood, which is something that she and Sharon actually do quite a bit of in this book, and they both had in many ways spectacularly horrible childhoods, which provides a lot of fodder for their craft, for their cartoons. Mm-hmm. The first scene that really occurred to me, there's a portion of the book where Mel is talking to Sharon about growing up in the Florida swamplands, and she's recalling the sort of neighborhood, the trailer park that she grew up in, and how the kids would throw marshmallows to the alligators in the swamps behind this trailer park, and how the alligators would kind of clamp their jaws together. And it's such a visual kind of anecdote, and such a vibrant anecdote that, you know, I think the threads of cartooning and of animation, something that's so bright and bombastic and active, came pretty easily to the rest of the plot. I knew that Mel and Sharon made things. I knew they were creative, and I knew that they were creative together. And I also knew that I didn't want to write about writers. I am the writer that I know best, and I am not very interesting. I suppose, in a way, I'm a huge cartoon fangirl who has no visual aptitude at all. I can't draw. I wish I could. I think, in a way, that story of them as animators, it made sense the way that they spoke to each other and the way they sort of saw the world, and especially the way Sharon, our narrator, sees the world. It's very visual. It made sense, but also I got the opportunity to vicariously live this life that I'll never have in this, through these characters.
That's the beauty of the novel.
For them, and it worked for me.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's the beauty of being a novelist, is you get to live all these great lives that you'll never get to lead, but you get to.
Right.
You get to lead it. Was it always in first person? It's in first person now from Sharon's point of view. Was that always the way, or did you kind of play around with third person?
I wanted this to be Sharon's story. And I knew that, I think, pretty solidly after the first draft, I think. Yeah. I never attempted a third person with these two characters. And I think a big part of that was, after writing that first draft of the book about 7 years ago, I guess. It feels like it's been a long time. I knew these characters. I knew Mel and I knew Sharon, but I knew Sharon less. I felt like Mel took up a lot of space on the page talking, especially in those initial drafts. And it made me wonder, you know, and Sharon was such a smart narrator, but also a really imbalanced narrator, and certainly an unreliable one. I wanted to know her better, in a way. And I think maybe for my personal reasons, I was drawn into first person over and over again. You know, I became addicted to Sharon's voice, in a way, and to delving underneath those layers that she kind of establishes around herself as a self-protective mechanism.
Very interesting. My guest this morning is Kayla Ray Whitaker. You know, if I don't have more coffee pretty soon, we're all going to be in trouble.
It's okay.
The book is The Animators. It is wonderful. It's published by Random House. So we've been talking a lot lately on the show about kind of all writing being political writing, and kind of the job of the artist in today's climate. And really, this book struck me on a couple of levels, both a women's story and the importance of telling stories of strong women who are creative and vibrant and independent, separate from men. And I was reading an interview with you. I'm really embarrassed to say that I'd never come across this test. I'm also going to probably butcher the name of the test, but the Bechdel test or the...
I think it's the Bechdel test,
Bechdel test.
I'm not quite sure either.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really embarrassed to say that I had never heard of it, and it's wonderful. And your book is such a wonderful example of it. So maybe just talk about the test.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so with the Bechdel test, and I actually hadn't heard of it, and I'd read Alison Bechdel's work and loved it, but I actually hadn't heard about the Bechdel test until probably last year, fairly recently too. So it's something that I'm glad it exists.
Yeah.
Basically, it's the theory that in order to pass the Bechdel test, the primary criteria is that there has to be at least one conversation between two women that does not involve a man. It's not contingent upon a male character. It's not contingent upon the welfare or the plot, the plot trajectory of a male character. People have the comparison or the metaphor I think people usually use is, can one of those female characters be replaced with a lamp? If she can be replaced with a lamp, then it doesn't pass the Bechdel test, you know. And I wish I could remember who said that, but it's really struck with me. It's great, yeah. I'm very happy to have written something that passes that test.
yes.
There is, you know, there is a romantic relationship. There are a couple of romantic relationships that take place in this book. But the story of the friendship is it really takes center stage, because I don't think there's any romantic relationship that is as central to the lives of these characters as their friendship with one another.
Right.
Their friendship with it's more defining of who they are and where they've been than anyone they've ever slept with, anybody they've ever had. You know, anybody they've ever dated. I'm glad I've written that story.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I've written a story about women making things. It takes a certain kind of agency that, on a personal level, and I think a lot of women feel this way, on a personal level, I feel like I'm still scrabbling for that sense of agency every day.
Uh-huh.
If you see a woman who's writing something or making something, it's easy to forget sometimes that she is essentially going against her conditioning as female.
Right.
And saying anything and making anything and putting her name to it. I mean, this is something that women still aren't raised to do this on a big level.
Right.
So in a way, I think writing this book, I was writing what I wanted to see. I was writing about characters I wanted so badly to exist. And, you know, God, what I wouldn't give for, you know, for Mel's bravery, for Sharon's bravery. They're really brave characters to make what they do. And they get a lot of flack for it. You know, there are characters, there are people in their lives who do not like that they're doing what they're doing, and so telling this story, it was important to me. There was a big part of my heart and a big part of my gut kind of invested in making this work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to go back to the notion that all writing is political, and I know you were writing this over the course of 7 years and have finished it certainly before we find ourselves in our current political quagmire.
Right.
But it's, you know, I mean, it's almost a lovely time for this book to come out into the world, because it's, these issues seem more urgent and relevant and, you know, urgent than ever. And I just think it's wonderful.
Yeah, I'm glad that it is very timely,
yeah.
Which is a wonderful thing. And one of the things that I found so touching about the Women's March, and especially when I see young girls getting involved in this, when I see teenage girls bringing up these subjects, I feel an immense sense of hope. They're bringing up really explicit issues that affect women, of course, like reproductive rights and, you know, really large issues that have been, you know, spoken about and written about for, you know, a long time. But they're also bringing up kind of the more implicit barriers to being female, like emotional caretaking,
uh-huh.
you know, and about silence and kind of being the custodian of the feelings of everybody around you, which I think women in a way that's silent but really powerful, that expectation is still, it's heaped upon us. And if you want to write or you want to make art for a living and you're worried about how other people feel, which you know, it's important to care for those around you, of course, but if it is impeding your way of life and if it's keeping you silent, then it needs to be addressed.
Right.
And it took me 20 years to put the words to that. You know, it's something that I've always felt and something that's always kind of stung, but it took me 20 years to figure out how to say it. So I'm glad that people are saying it and talking about it, and it's actually becoming a topic of talk.
Yeah, right. And I had read somewhere that you are sort of turning this grief about what's going on now. You say it's very rich for your writing, that anger and despair are very motivating. I love hearing you say that because I have just felt so dejected. I mean, it's really very hard to create art or to sort of think about, you know, what's it all for, Alfie? Right? What's the purpose here? And to be motivated and ignited by it. I think some really interesting things are going to rise out of the ashes of this. But I love the attitude that you have taken, that I'm just going to harness all of this energy and anger and grief and put it towards art, I think is the exact right response to this. It's great. The other aspect that you probably hadn't, I don't know if you realized you were writing about at the time you were writing it, but is now more relevant than ever is the issue of class. And part of the novel takes place in New York, part of it takes place in Kentucky. And then that's sort of our struggle right now. I mean, that really kind of crystallizes the two sides of our psyche here is city centers versus rural centers.
Yeah. And that's, it's something that I grew up with, of course. You know, I'm from Eastern Kentucky originally. I'm from Trump country. though it wasn't always Trump country. But, you know, it's this part of the South, you know, class is very, I mean, everywhere in the U.S., right? It's a huge deal, and it's a huge part of identity. But I think Americans, in a way, because of the idea of class ascension as the American dream, I mean, that's pretty much like this. That's one of the basic tenets of the American dream, right? Is, you know, kind of achieving class ascension. It is so deeply ingrained in our identity that, I mean, it really, you know, I think it gives you the impetus to work hard, definitely, but it will stick in your craw forever.
Yeah.
Right. And we definitely see this with the characters in the book, Sharon and Mel, you know, who, you know, they came from households that were, you know, like low five figures, probably.
Yeah.
You know, it's very like working class / lower middle class. And they end up, they go to this private liberal arts school in the Northeast where the world that they come from to the rest of their classmates, it might as well not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I mean, it'll, in some way, it may solidify that that kind of pride in where you're from in terms of your identity, but there's always a little piece of you that, you know, if you're put in an environment like that, I think when you're really young, you'll always kind of feel furtive.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it's a strange feeling, but in a way, you know, it makes the women, I think, more dogged and more determined and less afraid of having a low bank account, which is something that is going to happen if you write or you make art. You know, you're gonna be scrimping and just skating by at some point in your life. You know, it's probably going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
That's great. My guest is Kayla Ray Whitaker. The book is The Animators. There are some really wonderful lessons in Writers for Here that I want to get to. I told you we're going to talk all about craft, and then I just got into the guts of the book, and we didn't get to talk as much about craft as I need to have you on for like 3 hours because there's so much here. But one of the things that I really admired about this and then read in an interview you talking about is if you have the choice between writing something very elegant and pretty that isn't as emotionally true versus something kind of gritty and rough and raw, which gets to the heart of the matter, you would always choose the latter. And mm-hmm. I think that's such a really important lesson for especially newer, younger writers that truth wins out over the beauty of writing. I think writers can really get caught up in, language and does this. I mean, of course, it's always nice to have a beautiful sounding sentence. But if that is not serving what the story is about, it's not serving the book. And I just thought this novel did that perfectly, that these characters felt so accessible, the dialogue felt so authentic, and you really felt like you were in these women's lives, and sometimes I think language can be a little bit off-putting, too much literary mm-hmm. language can be off-putting. Can you talk a little bit about finding that voice and if that comes through the revision process or if that's something that is just kind of, there all the way along and how you make those choices?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It does come from a lot of revision. And I think one of my bad habits as a writer, and this is why I rely so heavily and I sing the praises of revision over and over again, is because my first drafts are terrible. They're terrible. And I don't know if they're getting better as I'm getting older. I have the tendency, and I think a lot of other people who read lots of literary fiction, and of course, I don't want to generalize, but because it goes from person to person, but maybe a lot of people who went through MFA programs, which I went through an MFA program, and it was wonderful, and I learned lots of great things about craft, and I'm a better writer for having gone through that program, but because you're reading literary fiction, everybody around you is reading literary fiction, there's lots and lots of overwriting, and it's easy. You kind of see it everywhere, and you do it yourself a lot, and I do it. I say that because I do it myself a lot, and part of revision for me is almost always cutting down crap.
Uh-huh.
And it's useless stuff. It's description and it's internal monologue and in a lot of ways those are the bits of fat that you have to produce along with the rest of the steak to really understand the story sometimes and the characters, because a lot of what you cut, it does lend to your internal understanding of the character and how the character is going to move through the story in a way that the reader doesn't really need to see. If the reader saw it, it would just be like getting their foot stuck in mud, and it slows them down in a big way. So I tend to think of that it's kind of writing what's true and what's essential to the story is sort of it's always my goal on the horizon. It's always what I'm shooting for, and I never get there on the first try. Almost ever,
We're out of time. I can't believe we're out of time. We're out of time. Is there a sentence or two that you can share advice, having come through this process and produced such a gorgeous first novel, with our listeners?
Oh, gosh. I would say, the first and best rule is to sit down and to write every day. And it's a very basic sounding rule, but it's really hard to do.
Yeah.
It's hard sometimes to fold that into the general fabric of your life. But that really is, even if you're just sitting and staring at a blank word screen for an hour, sitting down and doing it or trying to do it every day is really important. That's the first step I would take. If you think you have a novel in you, take it an hour at a time and try to just chip away at it bit by bit every day.
Yeah. You were 1,000 words a day was your goal, I heard.
Yeah, 1,000 words a day. Yeah. Yep. It's a good rule.
It's a good rule.
Yeah.
Kayla Ray Whitaker, I really appreciate this. The book is wonderful. It is out and available now. It is published by Random House. It is The Animators, and this was such a huge pleasure. I wish we had 3 more hours to talk.
I do too. Well, thanks so much again, Marie. This is really great.
It's
so
wonderful.
We appreciate it.
Thank you. That was Kayla Ray Whitaker. The book is The Animators, again, out and available. I will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. George Saunders will be my guest. Until then, stay tuned. Ponte La Pilas with Dre Gonzalez is coming up next. It is a little bit of Latin music. It is awesome. Stay tuned for that. You have been tuned in to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks for joining me. Have a great, great day.